The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another
Good
edition
evening.
Of the new WHFR Journal. Yes, that was Mayor John B. O'Reilly. He's just so excited to give his State of the City address all again one more time. That's right. This is from last Monday, March the 5th. And for those that didn't get there to see it in person, hear it in person, we are going to rebroadcast it in just about 30 seconds from now. And you can listen closely, take notes, and I've cut out the introductions, which saves about 10 minutes right there. All the famous people, of course, that we're attending from Dearborn, and Wayne County too.
Wait a minute, Dennis, we can't hear you. What mic are you on?
One.
There we go.
They never said our name. All those famous people. I think you just assume everybody heard us.
Well, yeah, we were in the darkness in the back broadcasting.
We were too
silently. And so Dennis and I will have a special guest after the mayor's State of the City address, which will last 35 minutes. Dave Norwood from the Sustainability Office of the City of Dearborn will be here for a special live in studio interview, and then we have more local area news and alternative views to finish up the hour today. So it's going to be very busy, and here we go. We're going to try to reset Mayor O'Reilly 4 seconds back, and this is the Dearborn State of the City address for 2012 from March the 5th.
Sort of maximum intensity for most of us last week in Michigan, with the first of three voting opportunities in 2012. I don't know about you, but I can't remember.
Well, that wasn't quite the beginning. Okay, here it goes. Here, I don't want you to miss anything.
Good evening. The presidential election cycle reached sort of maximum intensity for most of us last week in Michigan, with the first of three voting opportunities in 2012. I don't know about you, but I can't remember anything really positive value that I learned from any of the candidates, either their contacts or their ads. And given that fact, can you believe how much millions of dollars were spent on advertising and publicity? Here's the irony. The more money that's spent, the more muddled the overall picture becomes. Misrepresenting people and their positions takes its toll, leaving all of us as voters to wonder if anyone can make a real difference. It's a shame. especially during times when we need real leadership to set the stage for true dialogue, compromise, and positive action. How can we attempt to solve our very real problems if we can't talk about them with honesty and civility? The answer is, we can't. I'm raising this unfortunate reality because it stands in direct contrast to why we have and hopefully will continue to operate in a different way in Dearborn. And that has everything to do with our state of the city today. In Dearborn, our focus is on results. We can't worry about, you know, which group and this group. We worry first about our whole community. We pursue what's best for the future of our city because that is really what's best for all of us in the long term. This effective approach was clear this past November when Dearborn residents decided to approve the temporary millage and invest in the long-term interest of this community. Thank you for your faith in Dearborn. You've given us time to continue the necessary restructuring of our operation in an urgent but orderly way. A different outcome last November would have meant a very different discussion this evening. We view your endorsement of the millage not as a blank check, but instead as a 5-year annual contribution to our future. The money you are contributing will be providing the opportunity to keep Dearborn desirable and successful into the next generation. With that investment, we know you demand real results. As far as I'm concerned, to honor your trust in us, our deadline is to produce now, not 5 years from now. The best way to achieve these results is through a straightforward process I continually rely on. Identify priorities, define goals, and measure progress. A good example of how we've applied this process is in the performance dashboard we created as part of the state's Economic Vitality Incentive Program, EVIP. Now that's kind of a long name for a program the state initiated to really hold accountable local governments. And by complying with its 3 required phases, Dearborn secured critical additional revenue from the state. But even more importantly, the dashboard is a meaningful tool to measure our efforts and assess how we're doing as an organization. Essentially, it's our report card. And because many other communities will also have dashboards, you'll be able to compare our results with others. Now, the categories for the report card are good indicators of our financial strength, of our local economy, the power of it, and our quality of life. Our 2011 version is already on our website. The dashboard is designed to demonstrate how we progress from year to year, reaching our goals. But it is also designed to bolster your trust in us, because it can give you the confidence that we are measuring our efforts in a very public way. Now, I'm going to walk through some of the elements of it, and an important one measures our fiscal stability. Now, not surprisingly, there are some challenges here. But what our dashboard shows is that we are holding our own in this critical area, which is an achievement given the economic forces impacting us and the news from communities around us. It's also a reflection on the proactive steps we've already taken to position Dearborn for the long term. Another element is economic strength. Now, there are signs of hope in this category that slowly but surely recovery is moving in the right direction. We've been issuing more certificates of occupancy and more construction permits for businesses, indicating entrepreneurs and companies are choosing Dearborn. Now, here's another interesting indicator. We know that employers look for a well-educated population when deciding where to locate. In Dearborn, our college and university enrollment continues to grow, now to more than 30,000 students. Now, about 28,000 are in Henry Ford Community College and U of M Dearborn, but still, that's quite a college town. This is another way that we are positively positioning ourselves for the future. Our quality of life is reflected in the number of activities our community offers. And the dashboard shows that our participation in adult programs continues strong, and our youth programs are steadily rising. Now, the amount of investment in neighborhood amenities and infrastructure like roads is another indicator. Now, given our recent financial challenges, our general fund spending that we use for this broad category has decreased. But there are still some positive trends here. We've actively looked for and been successful at lowering maintenance costs. But we continue to make progress with our neighborhood stabilization program, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. Now, public safety is a concern and measured on several levels on our dashboard. While we know our perception of safety is as important as the numbers, the data gives us a solid reasons to remain confident. When crimes are reported, police are dramatically arresting more suspects. That amplifies a core message. If you commit a crime in Dearborn, it is likely you will get caught. And a lot of this has to do with the good work our police officers are putting forth and the excellent response times we have to high priority 911 calls. The data shows that response times are also great for our fire department on fire-related and ambulance calls. Now, these are just some of the markers on the dashboard. But you need to know that we are going to keep using it for ongoing improvement and as a powerful and objective way to report to you. We're also going to keep talking about our financial challenges because they're real and will continue to impact our service mix. We've been dealing with them since 2001, before it was common understanding that the economics of our nation, state, and community were permanently changing in historic ways. That early recognition and planning is why we remain in better shape now than many other cities. And because the city is primarily a service provider, personnel costs represent the majority of our expenditures, and also where we have to continue to make the biggest changes. And you've heard these statistics before. We've reduced our non-public safety full-time staff by as much as 35%, with some departments experiencing even more cuts. That means our employees are working harder with fewer resources. And reductions in staff will continue this year with 20 more positions that will be eliminated through attrition. We plan to implement the 80-20% cost-sharing measure for employees' health care, and that will start in July. We continue to negotiate with the city's unions for an overall $4 million reduction in personnel costs. We look to our unions as partners in developing realistic and sustainable benefits going forward. Now, we've already made great strides in the last 6 years with reducing future costs by restructuring retirement and benefit options for all new employees and by contracting out. Now, we're not only saving the costs of personnel, but we've eliminated the need to buy and maintain expensive heavy equipment like street sweepers. But despite these effective actions, we know we can't cut enough to meet our financial challenges. So we looked to other options, one being that we're trying to leverage through aggressively pursuing grants from other levels of government and from public foundations. Just a sample of our recent successes, we were awarded more than $900,000 in projects directed at improving the environment, more than $250,000 for recreation, and $300,000 for cultural activities, and more than $3.5 million for public safety. We also looked at controlling costs by relying on our community partners even more. In 2011, the nonprofit Dearborn Community Fund, right over here, accepted an important role in managing our homecoming event, eliminating the need for Dearborn to use dedicated funds to support the festival in the future. So we'll no longer be using any general tax funds for that event. They've also amplified the message that homecoming is a premier fundraiser for 24 nonprofit entities in our community who provide services to our community all year long. That means when you spend money at the event, at homecoming, you buy food, you buy beverages, you participate in any way, that the money that these groups make will serve the community. The city is not involved in collecting the money or spending your money. And that's an important element, because homecoming is a treasured event, but we've transformed it into one that has become self-sustaining and does what it's supposed to do, make the community a better place to live. Now, we have another example with our Recreation and Parks Department. With the Recreation Commission, about a dozen of our sports organizations, and the Dearborn Public Schools, we are looking at eliminating duplication, lowering costs, and strengthening sports programs for our youth. We had a wonderful program with the Dearborn Public Schools called Books and Basketball, and it was very successful. We took care of the basketball port, our center, and the school helped with homework improvement with students who were challenged. And so we were able to really bring in students who needed some help and give it to them in a way that they found attractive. And those are things we hope to continue to pursue, because we can see that it's having an impact. As a community, we need to be willing to try even more innovative approaches to keep Dearborn moving forward. We've been actively working on, with a Save Our Pools group, on alternative funding for 6 neighborhood pools. This option would let local property owners who live within that catchment area to vote on whether they want to pay a special assessment to operate their nearest neighborhood pool. By exploring this with Save Our Pools, we're trying to preserve the services that our residents treasure, while at the same time recognizing a new economic reality. In these times, advocating for your favorite service or program also means coming forward with willingness to seek solutions and keep an open mind. We must accept change as inevitable. And if we're going to remain a viable community, we're going to need to recognize an inherent part of change is acknowledging that it can be messy at times. It involves starts and stops. As we explore many ideas, we'll find some end up being better than others. But the consideration of all of these ideas is important to finding the best solutions. As we explore ways to preserve the heart of Dearborn, we must always focus on our core services, especially public safety. As we've seen the economy decline, it seems like we're feeling a little more vulnerable now in our neighborhoods. And that is not how we want to feel about Dearborn. Well-publicized cases can add to that uneasiness, like a string of home burglaries. But when that happens, you can be confident that our police department takes a comprehensive approach by using targeted tactics, engaging citizens, and teaming with other agencies. And that has proved once again successful by a number of recent arrests, leading to the resolution of some of these high-profile crimes. Our sense of security is also dependent on our fire department and responses in medical emergencies. Now, Dearborn has an outstanding relationship with Oakwood Hospital. Outcomes for heart attack and stroke patients have been dramatically improved through greatly reduced treatment times. In our city, when our response team arrives at the site of the call, they are prepared immediately to begin to do things like administer an EKG. That gets sent to the phone of the emergency room physician, who can look at the EKG even before the patient is secured and ready for transport. And we can begin to administer treatment, particularly in stroke and heart cases. That means that we can give them medicines that will not only help stop the incident itself, but mean that recovery can be much more successful because less damage is done. Now, as an example, the national target for emergency angioplasty treatment is within 90 minutes. That's the target. Dearborn Fire and Oakwood Hospital do it in 40 minutes. And a recent case in Dearborn, a patient received angioplasty treatment in an incredible 22 minutes. Now, maintaining these types of remarkable services is harder in the face of financial threats, but it's still important because, after all, here we're talking about life, whether it's yourself or someone you love. You know, what is that cost and how do we manage it? Dearborn has not faltered and we have not backed away from our commitment. 83%, I think it's 93% of our firefighters have full emergency qualification. Now, most of you saw that, you know, we're still in decline. I mean, when you got your tax bills last week and you looked at them, I'm sure the first thing is you were pleased to see that your tax liability would probably be lower than you thought it would be. But, you know, it's still a matter because one of the problems we have is that with that situation, okay, we have still those challenges. And for the city, this additional 9%, which is what we lost, so just to give you an idea this year, we lost 9% this year alone in residential property value. Now, that's a direct correlation to 9% of our budget. So that translates into $3 million less revenue we'll have just for that. And we haven't yet got the recorded losses in value in commercial industrial property. So when we look at this, the city now has lost 33% of residential property tax revenue in the last 6 years. Now, try to imagine how the loss of one-third of your own household income would impact your family functions. Now, we're looking for good news. We got good news on one front. Dearborn's inventory of houses, which is measured by the number of months that it would take to have a property move off the market, has dramatically improved. In 2004 and earlier, it averaged about 8 months. But it spiked to 14 months in the worst of the recession in 2008. Well, today, the inventory stands at 4.3 months. So properties are selling. But the corresponding bad news is that the actual prices don't reflect this increase in demand. This is due to flawed financing policies of banks from way outside of our community who are not willing to finance prices that buyers and sellers have agreed are appropriate, but their brokered appraisers won't recognize because they don't understand our market. And that is happening to a lot of people, and it's creating a real problem because we have the opportunity to sell properties, but the way that the system after the banks were loaning to everybody, now this brokered system has turned it around, and they're comparing a property in Dearborn to a property totally unrelated that has no value, but we can't fight that. So unless you're using our local banks, which is my advice, use our local banks, you're going to have a hard time, even though the buyer and seller know that the price is correct. Another potential financial threat is the proposed elimination of industrial personal property tax being discussed now in Lansing. At risk for us is about $12 million a year that the city receives in revenue. Now, that's a staggering 20% of our general tax collection. Without any reliable replacement for this tax established in 1893, our services will have to be remarkably different. As a realist, I'm convinced that the days of the levying that particular tax may be numbered. It seems to be the political wind. I also understand that over the past 15 years, the share of the total tax burden for supporting city functions has been shifting to residential taxpayers while it's been lessening for industrial taxpayers. And that's due to policies, particularly at the state level. That is why I am determined to help craft a suitable alternative. As a member of a special task force of business and local leaders organized by the Southeast Michigan Council of Governments, SEMCOG, I proposed a way to lessen the burden on industry and still protect critical local services. Now, Ford Motor Company was represented on the task force and has been a crucial and positive part of the development of this proposed alternative. We've had several positive meetings with Lieutenant Governor Calley, and his staff to discuss this concept. I'm hoping for a reasonable solution that is workable, if not ideal, for both businesses and the communities they rely on for essential services. The financial struggles of cities that border Dearborn represent another threat. While we can't do anything directly to assist, we can and have reached out to these to partner with them and to try and offer services more cost efficiently. For instance, our Management Information Department, IT as we like to call them, will be paid for providing tech services to support Dearborn Heights, and for them at a cost lower than what they've been paying a contractor. Another approach is reciprocal agreements to better leverage resources. Under this model, Dearborn and Dearborn Heights residents can share libraries at no cost or any other provision, and that successful arrangement is now in its second year. Another strategy is to work with neighboring communities to create more efficient ways to deliver across the region. Now, all of these efforts play a vital role as we look to Dearborn's future. Our vision going forward can be guided by Dearborn's past, but it needs to recognize very different dynamics we're facing as we fight for our future. Consider the depth of these differences. Now, one example I like to use is the Ford Motor Company and its impact on the economic vitality of Dearborn. At one point, Ford Motor Company paid in the neighborhood of 70% of the total general tax revenue collected by the city of Dearborn. That was many years ago, and today that number is below 30%. Ford has had an impact on our economic vitality in another way also. Dearborn economy has always been bigger than its geographic size and population. That's because of the daily mix of people historically brought in by Ford and Ford-related enterprises. The Rouge plant, for example, employed at one time more than 80,000 people within its gates, and then another 150,000 or more were employed by Ford at other locations in Dearborn. Now, the collective demand of employees living and working in Dearborn and people visiting Dearborn could be felt everywhere, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in our retail stores, our professional shops, and in our collective sense of vitality. Ford has dramatically restructured since that time, and therefore, many fewer Ford employees spend time in Dearborn. And additionally, those who do come to Dearborn have less opportunity to eat or shop due to significant lunch policy changes that have really been very effective for Ford. These changes have been good for their productivity, for traffic patterns, for security, all good for Ford Motor Company, but very difficult for many Dearborn businesses. Now, I recognize that Ford took these actions because they were part of an effective business plan, and we are all pleased with their success. But it leaves us with the challenges to create a new economic model for Dearborn. This requirement to be more self-reliant comes at a time when the city's resources have been compromised due to other factors. So not only do we have the burden of these new roles, but we have to do it with less capacity and manage significant change. To say these are vastly different times is underselling the reality we're facing. But I didn't take this job to shy away from challenges. So I started to focus on a couple of key factors in Dearborn's equation of success. One of these factors is people. We need to do whatever we can to bolster demand, and that's why we're working so hard in finding other ways to attract more people to Dearborn. Now, one of these ways is with our new intermodal train station. Once completed, once track improvements are made for high-speed rail, we're talking about 110 miles an hour, and we start commuter runs, which are going to start event runs now but should be coming, I strongly believe it will mark the beginning of a major revolution in how people use mass transit in our region. It will be a magnet that will open up Dearborn to new markets all over the region and further on to the west. For instance, with improved travel time, projected to be 4 hours between Dearborn and Chicago, then we're in a position to begin to advertise getaway trips to Chicago area residents to come to Dearborn and spend a weekend with all kinds of activities that are within 10 minutes of our hotels. Another approach is a convention center next to the 772-room Hyatt Hotel. You know, imagine 1,800 to 2,000 people coming to Dearborn in three-day cycles all year long. The study supporting the convention center said that it would bring $137 million of new spending to the Dearborn area. And of that, $88 million would be from out-of-state visitors who don't even come and spend money today in Michigan. Now, that's another tremendous magnet and would represent a boon to countless businesses and institutions in our community. We're also continuing to be supportive of Ford Motor Land and its recruiting efforts to attract more businesses to Dearborn. Among its successes are the Business Ready Suites, where they're opening up their doors to entrepreneurs, to new startup businesses, and it's been amazingly successful. At its peak, Ford Motor Land had 1.75 million square feet of vacant Class A office space in Dearborn. That's phenomenal, but that represents all those people that had worked for Ford and were no longer coming here. And they're aggressively filling it up. And in 2010, they re-leased over 400,000 square feet and then got 440,000 square feet of new tenants. They're doing an outstanding job. Another thing is the Carhartt Company. We're the international headquarters, and they've had that here, but they're expanding and adding another 41,000 square feet to their operation as we continue to be their world headquarters. And the new Henry Ford Medical Center on Ford Road, which is part of the Fairlane development, and they've opened a whole other campus, and it's created a lot of opportunity. It's been able to expand. They're going to redevelop the old Fairlane site and reorganize things, but it's still growth, and it's growing in a very positive way for us. And then another is our great friends and our second biggest employer, and that's Oakwood Hospital. And Oakwood continues to look to expand, to develop, and to meet the needs of not only Dearborn, but the region. And they're doing a positive impact on our local economy. Yet another way to attract people is through art space, real estate projects. Now, ArtSpace is a nationally recognized nonprofit developer and currently owner of 31 live work spaces in metropolitan areas all over the country. Now, their success is built on a time-tested development strategy that has seen artists and creative people renovate business districts in urban areas by living and working in publicly accessible venues. Their presence continues to attract new residents and visitors and to bring documented economic benefits. In addition to attracting visitors to Dearborn, my second goal is to make sure that we have a service mix that continues to appeal to both current and new residents. Our bottom line is that Dearborn must remain a community with more draw, better standards, and a higher level of customer service than other cities in the region. Our service mix is unique. It covers a broad spectrum. I mean, if you think about Dearborn, we go from very low end to high end golf course fronted homes in three different places. We cover a large socioeconomic profile, much larger than any other suburban community in our area. So we have a lot of assets we take for granted, or sometimes we don't even appreciate as well as we could. But we are unique, and our service mix is unique, and it plays a large role in meeting the goal I just spoke about. My intention is to find smart alternatives to services we need to change and to maintain all that we reasonably can. Protecting our neighborhoods is a priority. And since our comprehensive neighborhood stabilization began in 2008, we've purchased more than 205 eyesore homes. Most were demolished, but 20 of them have been earmarked for rehabilitation. Five are ready right now for new first-time home buyers. Since 2008, we've reduced the number of reported vacant homes by 34%. We continue to require that all vacant property must be registered, and we're assertive in monitoring outside appearances. Maintaining our property standards is even more important as the number of rentals has increased. It's a trend that is in other respected communities as well. And I know it's a trend that makes residents uneasy about their property values. So I've organized a task force of council members, landlords, realtors, neighborhood leaders, and staff to review our rental housing practices and policies. And we're looking at measured approaches that have been successfully implemented to bolster neighborhoods not only around Michigan but all over the country. This has led to some changes already, and we're looking forward to more. But remember, we already require rental properties to be registered. Neighbors can report homes that they suspect are rented but not on the list, and they can do that by email, online, or simply by calling us. We inspect all rental properties every 3 years and when there's a change of ownership. So often it's the case that here, if you have a rental property, it's going to be inspected a lot more than an owner-occupied property. But we all want our housing stock to meet standards that are ones that we as home buyers want to know and homeowners, and we want to have confidence in them. Now, we know it is a goal we all share. We are reorganizing our team of field inspectors to heighten efficiencies and serve you better. It will help increase our fair and consistent application of property maintenance rules throughout our neighborhoods. We also hope to partner with two groups, including Habitat for Humanity, to build homes in Southeast and East Dearborn to bring fresh options for people who may want to live in Dearborn and become homeowners. This will help us convert new people that we can attract to go from visitors to residents, which is one of the primary goals also. And we want to do that so that we can retain residents that we already have and who appreciate the many advantages of living in a real community, one where neighbors know and care about each other, where children can thrive in a safe and nurturing environment, and where city government is committed to supporting a quality of life that's second to none. And that quality of life must also include environmental sustainability. Now, we've done a lot on that front. I talked earlier about a number of grants we've gotten. One of the things this year we're doing is we've gotten a grant to put in 300 new high-efficiency LED streetlights in areas around our city. We've expanded our electric vehicle charging stations, and our new train station will be LEED certified through environmental design standards. And since 2010, we've increased our residential curbside recycling by 40%. So Dearborn already had one of the most participatory programs in the region, and we've gone and increased that greatly. I strongly believe we have our priorities identified. To meet our goals, I know we have the talent and determination. During my time as mayor, I've experienced the extraordinary skills and commitment of our city employees. Just as important, I also know that we have the flexibility to change course if necessary to realize better results. I can't honestly tell you where the country will be heading after the elections in November, but I can tell you that the city will be meeting its many challenges and positioning itself for a bright future. Our way has proven to be the right way, and as someone who has worked at all three levels of government, I can confidently tell you that local government is the level where government works as it was intended to work, by, for, and of the people. It is participatory in the most direct sense and is truly accountable to the people it serves. Ask any of the council members or other elected officials when they go out to the grocery, the restaurant, or any event, okay? It is directly accountable. But because of this, we can face the future with confidence, knowing that Dearborn is full of difficult changes overcome by a community that has always pulled together. There's no reason to believe that we can't do the same today. While we may be facing some of the toughest challenges we've ever faced, our commitment and our capacity has never been greater. We proved that last November, and we're going to keep proving it, because we are one community, one considerable force standing united to ensure that this city remains the best place in the world to make our homes, to raise our families, enjoy our friends, and follow our dreams. Thank you.
You've been listening here to the recording that we made 5 days ago, Monday, March the 5th at City Hall. That's Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. And that's his word about what's happening in the city, what's happened in the last year, and where we're going in the future. It's all very positive and supportive, even though there's still challenges ahead and budget cuts ahead. So I hope you enjoyed that. Tell your friends. They can go at any time, whfr.fm, click on talk shows, and then WHFR Journal, and today's date, March 9th, and they can listen or download this whole hour, in fact. And the first 35 minutes or 40 minutes almost now has been John B. O'Reilly. So more coming up right after a couple of great comments, as most every Friday we have, from Jim Hightower.
You thought that yesteryear's threat of creeping communist cells inside the USA was the worst conspiracy in our history? Or maybe you think that foreign terrorists pose the greatest threat ever. Well, get ready to be whopper-jawed, Americans, for it turns out that the most insidious assault on the very... You thought that yesteryear's threat of creeping communist cells inside the USA was the worst conspiracy in our history? Or maybe you think that foreign terrorists pose the greatest threat ever. Well, get ready to be whopper-jawed, Americans, for it turns out that the most insidious assault on the very fabric of our nation is coming from within, from a radical and subversive organization dedicated to warping the minds of our children. Yes, that devious group is... the Girl Scouts. Luckily, though, our nation has such alert patriots as Bob Morris to warn that the Girl Scouts are coming. The Girl Scouts are coming. Bob, an Indiana Republican legislator, recently drew a bright line in the political sand by being the only member of that august body to withhold his signature from a resolution celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. It seems that Bob found allegations on the internet that these supposedly innocent cookie-peddling kiddos are really a tactical arm of Planned Parenthood, promoting casual sex, the homosexual lifestyle, abortion, and, worst of all, liberal progressive politics. And in case you're one of those fact addicts who don't believe everything on the internet, Bob offers this damning proof of the girl group's perversion. First Lady Michelle Obama is honorary president of this, quote, radicalized organization. This, he warns his fellow Republicans in a letter, should give each of us reason to pause. Never mind that Laura Bush previously served as honorary president. This is Jim Hightower saying, in bleeping credible. Only, this bobblehead of right-wing BS is not alone. At least one extremist church outfit is asking members to pray against the Girl Scouts, claiming that these kids' cookie sales amount to blood money. Well, let's just all pray that Rick Santorum doesn't discover this conspiracy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Every day on the job, hundreds of miners descend deep into the earth. And every time they go down, each of them wonders, will I make it back to the top today? These days, though, miners and their families are wondering if federal prosecutors will make it to the top, wondering whether justice will catch up to the top honchos of Massey Energy, who are responsible for killing 29 mine workers in a horrific methane explosion deep inside the corporation's upper Big Branch mine 2 years ago. So far, no. But even the odious former CEO of Massey, Don Blankenship, must now be having some sleepless nights, for the Justice Department has steadily been climbing up the corporate ladder. Prosecutors have gone from indicting a couple of lower-level Massey managers to now nailing Gary May, who was superintendent of Upper Big Branch when it blew. The charges against May show a corporate-wide, careless culture of profit over safety and a deliberate policy of deceiving mine safety inspectors. May allegedly directed workers to falsify official safety record books, and he used codes to warn workers that inspectors had arrived, calling out, "Bringing in a load of blocks," and "There's a hailstorm outside." So warned, workers were expected to act quickly to hide such violations of safety laws as rigging the ventilation system to make the air in the mine seem better than it really was. May is also charged with such deadly practices as ordering the rewiring of a methane monitor to keep miners working even as levels of explosive methane rose dangerously. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Superintendent May is not likely to be the Justice Department's final rung on its climb up Massey's corporate ladder, for he appears to be cooperating with prosecutors. I think we'll find that the murderous conspiracy to subvert safety laws ran all the way to the top.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
And we're back with live in the studio with the new Dearborn Journal, which is called the new WHFR Journal. It used to be called 20,000 years ago the Dearborn Journal, and then CDTV in Dearborn took our name. And so, but we wanted to talk about more than Dearborn anyway, Dearborn and the surrounding area. So now it's the WHFR Journal. Dennis Reimars is here with me in the studio, our WHFR news director and reporter for the Press and Guide newspaper. Pretty hot stuff, Dennis.
I don't know. Just it's some freelance work, and I'm grateful.
Some good stories. I read you covering the usually boring meetings in Dearborn Heights. Dearborn Heights is your beat now. Beat up by it.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you think city council, you know, before I should say, and I'll be honest, I thought, mm-hmm. you know, grass growing, watching paint dry. Actually, it is rather dynamic. And as a council member for Dearborn Heights, Lisa Hicks Clayton said, it's a mm-hmm. very fluid thing. It's dynamic because there's a lot of changes and people discuss things. They may have a decision made or they think they do. And then when they discuss it, they come up with a different idea.
Right. Right.
And I think that's the power of you. You have seven people that are brainstorming, I guess. We have quite a bit to go over here.
Yeah, maybe. We're sorry to say that Dave Norwood, who was scheduled to be here live today, is not here with us, so we're going to reschedule that. I'm sure he's out doing something very sustainable.
I would think so.
He's not in the office. We try to call there.
And in all fairness, we saw him at the State of City Address, and mm-hmm. we at that point said, hey, you know what, we would love to talk to you this Friday, and he agreed, was looking at his plan. And I did email him, but anything could have happened. So, Dave, we would like to reschedule if it's an option.
Right, and because nothing's more important than sustainability. Obviously, we're all interdependent in this country and even in this world to a certain extent. Like, our water comes from Detroit. I hope they don't raise the price too much to make the city budget balance. But it's just not feasible for us to build our own water and sewage processing plant on the Rouge River. You know, we just can't do that. So there are things we have to share in this region, at least, and that's some of it. Obviously, waste and trash disposal, we get a lot of that. The recycling goes on. We have to pay people to take care of that. But there's a lot of issues, and his office, just so you know, folks, Dave Norwood, we're talking about, Dearborn Sustainability Coordinator, has gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions even, of grants to forward us into a more energy-efficient, cleaner environment in the future.
And that's a really good point because, you know, his office is, as you put it, sustained based on grant money that he secures.
Right.
So when the mayor, and I believe the figure in his state of the city address was $900,000 grant, a recent grant for a sustainable grant for environmentally conscious projects.
Right.
Dave Norwood was and we don't know that he's, you know, I'm sure he has a team of people that he works with, but moves forward with these particular grants. And from what I understand, and this is a question I had for him and I will continue to have when we see him, if his entire office is based on these grants. Because I think that's what I inferred when we first had him on.
I know he's said in our past interview that his office has no budget, but whether or not his salary comes directly from the city,
that's the question.
Obviously, it's still subtracted salary. It still makes ton of money for the city on projects that will save the city more or keep our environment cleaner or get it cleaner in the future. And I also wanted to ask him about, so if he's listening and very feeling guilty or at least very busy and doing important things, we do want to ask also how can we can volunteer all to help with projects he's got going.
Absolutely.
I know he partners with the Sierra Club in the local Detroit area, as well as League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, who have also partnered with Sierra Club. So if we all get together and work on these things, it'll even be better. And a lot of local volunteers are needed for this effort. Again, because his office has no budget, folks. How sustainable can that be? That's really fantastic.
And it really
is. That's the whole concept. And, of course, somebody's going to jokingly say, well, maybe all city government should be sustainable. Well, okay, but we don't have enough grants for the basic public services.
That's true.
Nobody's giving a grant for basic water, you know, or basic trash collection. Right now, the grants are going to things that will move us in a new direction. And then once we get pretty sustainable, we can go on. But we have a lot of other stories to cover here, and we'll get in touch with Dave Norwood in the future.
I had a question. You said something about the city of Detroit raising their prices because of their own economic woes.
I'm only guessing. The city of Detroit, the water supply is from the city of Detroit. They operate the water supply.
Right.
And they probably got some sort of commission or board that supervises it. But it's not a county board, is it? I mean, I think they can raise the prices however they need to cover their cost, and with the city of Detroit being in financial straits, this has got to be the only profit-making thing they got going in this
city. It's kind of a monopoly, too, so sure.
Yeah, but of course the whole region needs it. It's one of those examples, maybe we need a regional government to really control and regulate these things, but so I'm just guessing water and clean water is going to become more and more important. We're very spoiled here in the Detroit area. We think we just turn on the taps anytime we want to or flush the toilet whenever we want to. Many other cities in the United States, especially in the Southwest, don't have that option. They have water restrictions. They have water, you know, they can only... there's a lot of crazy things about the things. Like sometimes years ago in Detroit, it used to be you could only water on odd or even number of days depending on our house street address.
Right.
So if you were an even numbered street address, divisible by two, folks, for those that don't know what even means, then you could water on an even day of the month, like the 2nd or the 4th or the 8th or whatever.
How far back does that go? Because
it started in the 50s, you know.
So even then they were conserving and right?
There were some water shortages. Now, they probably increased the production of the plants, but if a drought hits in the near future, even in this area, we'll have to start conserving more. So anyway, it's all these issues are really the most important ones,
yeah,
and will become more so in the near future. Here's right. The stories, summarize some of the stories from Dearborn Press and Guide last Sunday. Thought it was ironic in a way that Fortson High School had a meeting about a week or so ago on a Tuesday. Now, apparently it wasn't well promoted or advertised. It was all about anti-bullying and what the school district has done at Fortson High School to stop what's referred to as a skank letters being circulated, I think, among to senior girls or girl or two, not all of them necessarily. And that means, I guess, they're just not so desirable.
Sure.
Not pretty or intelligent enough or, I don't know, what it takes to be a skank or a non-skank these days, having been in high school for a while. But the meeting itself turned chaotic, as was described in the headline to the story. A lot of parents behaving badly. And I'm thinking,
irony.
Maybe it's because those same parents behaved similarly badly at home that some of these kids are following their example by behaving badly whenever they want to in school or to criticize others. Fortson High School administrators did take about a week, maybe 2 weeks, before they actually began disciplinary hearings on the boys that did it, which they were able to find and track down and so on. And so calling somebody a skank, I guess, is just as bad as some sort of sexual harassment. I guess that is sexual harassment in a way.
It could be, sure.
Or racial epithets or whatever. So.
Well, I don't know. Like you said, there's different interpretations for the word. At the same time, the city acted late is what some people are mm-hmm. saying, but they did act.
Yeah, and give me a break here, you know. nobody was hurt or injured, and nobody really was raped or directly harmed or outed, you know.
Right.
Somebody saying you're revealing you're homosexual when you might be. Of course, I think it's worse to be revealed that you're homosexual when you're not. But, you know.
It's worse to be revealed as anything that you're not.
Either way, you're in trouble, you know, about right. that. But those are the typical things that usually we know immediately have traumatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
In my day, of course, in high school, maybe we all had tougher skins, but everybody was sort of just in interpersonal relationship. Oh, she's a skank. Or we never used that word, but, you know, she's dorky or she's ugly or he's handsome or he's stupid or whatever. I mean, in a way, they're kind of descriptive terms until you get going further.
They're kind of vague, though.
Yeah, but we didn't, you know, we just had tougher skins then, and people just got along with it. That was my thought anyway. I mean, I was called, the big insult was smart.
Really?
Yeah, because I always sat up front, teacher's pet, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I always answered the questions. I always did my studying, my homework. And so, water on a duck's back.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, tough. I'm learning stuff. Ha ha. You know.
I'll see you on the radio.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, whatever. I'm going to be a teacher in college. Okay. Whatever it takes here. That's unfortunate. Just quite ironic. And shame on you parents for doing that. I think the schools did the best they could. Maybe they could have done a little faster. Okay. Now, both the schools, mentioning the schools, Dearborn and Dearborn Heights schools, the results are in the papers from last Sunday and also from this last Wednesday's edition. So 3-4-12 and 3-7-12 of the Dearborn Press and Guide. The MEEP scores, Michigan Educational Assessment Program scores, testing science, math, reading, whatever, in the state compared to among the state, very low scores, apparently even lower in Dearborn Heights than Dearborn. And you can read about those. But the test was changed to help the schools out here. And they are tougher tests now. So it's assumed that that's one of the reasons the scores are lower.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. Are these the tests that specific funding is based on the results of these tests? Are these?
It's getting contingent on. Yeah, I know. My daughter said that some merit pay money, mm-hmm. extra incentive money, goes to the teachers whose classrooms did better on the tests, which is only directly going to try to get them to cheat, you know, or teach to the test. Neither of which is any good. Not that my daughter does in Southfield, but
I just remember when my kids were in high school, and it wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. The teachers spent quite a few days before the test the kids specifically ready for these tests.
Yeah, and that's not fair.
And there was a lot of pressure on the teachers as well as the students to perform.
Well, there still is, right?
Okay.
And let's not forget that teacher funding, school funding, continues to decline. Teachers are heavily demoralized. The latest thing that will probably be signed into law today is that all union dues, which are paid monthly out of teacher salaries at K-12 and also at colleges, like we have teacher unions here at Henry Ford Community College, they're not going to be allowed by state law, if signed into law today by Governor Snyder as expected. They can't deduct them from our paycheck anymore. We'll have to write a separate check every month, all teachers, all college professors in the state of Michigan.
Is that to save money?
No, because an addendum to the, to make it inconvenient, because teachers are always doing petitions and trying to, you know, get laws changed or fight laws that the Republicans, especially in the last year, have been putting up, like forcing the teachers to pay 20% of their health care. And maybe that's right. Maybe that's not. It's becoming the norm. But, teachers don't get that much, folks. Excuse me, they don't. It's a terrible thing, considering their responsibilities and the importance of their job. And then to hit them with a 20% responsibility for their health care, which is not cheap. Health care costs, I think it's about a third of whatever your pay is. And so that's thousands of dollars a year or more they're hit with. And you say, well, they deserve it. They do. You want them to do a worse job? You want them to be less well-motivated? You want poorer teachers hired, if anybody's ever hiring a teacher in the future who would want the job anymore? Things are really tough. But I'm all for accountability, you know. But this constant harassment by the state Republicans and the governor, if he signs this thing, it doesn't make sense. In fact, the Democrats said, well, if it's a money thing, and the Democrats in the Senate, the Michigan Senate, said, here's an amendment. We'll just add it on that the district will tell us what their costs are for this deduction. You know, it's like computer time or whatever to calculate it. And it's got to be pennies, okay?
Right.
And guess what? The Republicans in the Senate vetoed that amendment. So it's not about cost. It's about harassing the teachers. Just not right. Just not fair. And, of course, that will start with the next contract, whenever that is, probably September for most schools and school districts. So even the school administrators have said, it's not going to save us hardly anything. They're already in the system. It's just a computer that automatically churns out the deduction. It's, you know, and then we do electronic transfer to the union's bank account, you know, with the dues. It's just a convenience. It's just, it's like you're belonging to a criminal organization, a union. You know, how are you going to get rights as an employee? How are you really going to stand up for your rights and get a fair shake from your employer anywhere without a union? And it was pointed out several other places this week, including on Craig Folly's show on DET, nobody studies union history. Nobody remembers the struggles. They don't know how and why unions got there and what good they've done and what good they still have to do. Not all unions, of course, just like not all governments have very competent, intelligent, or honest administrators, but I don't think the unions are any worse off than anybody else in that regard. And it's just basic fact of history, folks. Go read your history books about the unions, how they got started and why, and what purpose they've served in making this a better country. Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. It's time for Highway 61 with Joanne Kay coming up next here on WHFR, WHFR.fm. The station making waves.
Remember, next week we have in studio. Isn't next week March 16th? Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
And we'll have Mr. State Representative George Durrani.
Yes, he's definitely going to be here.
Yes. Now, is he going to be here right at one? Oh, I got that.
Yes.
Will he be right at one?
Yes, okay. I believe so, because his meetings at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center with the seniors are the last Friday of each month. So almost on purpose, he wanted to be here at the start of the show, and we'll make sure he is.
That's awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
we'll reschedule Mr. Norwood as well.
Yes, we will. And in 2 weeks, oh boy, on the 30th, we have Circuit Court Judge Mark Summers.
That's right. That's right.
Here. So that's going to be an exciting time.
That really
also
will.
To get some questions answered and talk to him about his next step. In elected office, in fact. And we'll talk to Mark Summers on the 30th and George Durrani next week. So come on back or check out our website, WHFR.fm, the station making waves. And here's the blues.